Miracles in My Life, the autobiography of Adventist pioneer J.N. Loughborough. In 1852, John N. Loughborough, unimpressive in appearance and slight of build, began a determined evangelism for Seventh-day Adventists. Undaunted by blizzards and bitter cold, he traveled by buggy and sleigh over trackless prairies and baffling forest trails of the Midwest. Beginning his California labors in 1868 with a 60-foot tent in Sonoma County, he attracted overflow crowds, made many converts, but was frequently threatened and narrowly escaped death from an angry, knife-wielding opponent. Few, if any, of our Adventist pioneers covered such a long span of years as Loughborough, 1832 to 1924. Fewer still recorded their experiences in as many publications. Loughborough's close association with Elder and Mrs. White enables him to include many faith-building incidents in connection with the gift of prophecy and also adds interest to his personal narrative. His eyewitness account is effective and authentic. The material in this manuscript comes from books, diaries, articles, and field reports in Adventist publications. The lengthy sermonettes have been eliminated, archaic expressions updated, but the story, the style, is his own. I trust it will meet a timely need for the generation who knew not Loughborough. A flash ahead. Madame Parrott never dreamed that her decision to ride side saddle to the tent meeting would draw the attention of the entire community, nor did she foresee her near fatal accident and her healing so miraculous that even atheists could not deny. Among those who attended John Loughborough's evangelistic meetings at Santa Rosa was a young medical graduate from Geneva known as Madame Parrott. An urgent sick call took her to the bedside of Mrs. Skinner at Piner. After a week's cot duty, her patient had so recovered that Dr. Parrott announced her intention to return to the tent meetings. Mrs. Skinner's atheist son, Oliver, readied a horse that was used to ladies, but as she mounted, he began to buck furiously. She was thrown to the ground, and the horse upon her with such force that it bent the saddle horn out straight. As her friends looked upon her mangled form, they felt certain she was dead. When she regained consciousness, she could barely whisper. "Shall we send for a doctor?" someone asked her. "No," she responded. "A doctor can do me no good. Send for the ministers at the tent. If they pray for me, the Lord will heal me." Elders Loughborough and Bardot had just begun their evening meeting when the prayer request reached them. Thinking it unwise to dismiss their congregation, they promised to come very early the next morning. When they arrived, they learned that the doctor's condition had required 4 attendants throughout the night. "Anoint me and pray, and the Lord will heal me," she whispered. As the ministers prayed, Dr. Parrott soon began to pray in a loud voice, then clapped her hands and declared, "I am healed." She arose, dressed herself, and began to assist with the home duties. In the evening, she rode to the meeting in a lumber wagon, completely free from all pain. Former atheist Oliver now enthusiastically witnessed of God's power to everyone he met. Chapter 1, My Early Years. Many have requested me to give some remembrance of early times and manifestations of the Lord's dealings with his people. Having been familiar with the Advent movement of 1843 to 1844, and having since January 2, 1849, proclaimed the doctrine, I esteem it a pleasure to speak the things which I have seen and heard. I will first call attention to some things in my own early life. I was born in Victor, Ontario County, New York, January 26, 1832. My father was an earnest local Methodist preacher. When I was 3 years of age, a Miss Bibbins started a school for little tots in one of the classrooms of the Methodist church. On the last day of school, we were all taken into the sanctuary where our parents and others were assembled to hear recitations. Among the rest, I was called upon to make my first public speech, which consisted of a bit of poetry I had learned. When the people clapped their hands, I did not know it had had any reference to what I had done, so supposed it to be their part of the meeting. In our childhood days, our parents took us little folks to the love feasts and the communion seasons of the church. I well remember that as testimonials were born in those love feasts, they were moistened with tears and accompanied with shouts of praise that touched our young hearts. I remember, too, how plainly the people dressed, neatly, yet without any display of jewelry. In those days, those who were to partake of communion received a ticket from the class leader. One woman did not get a ticket because she had worn gold. Shortly afterward, her daughter was excluded from church for attending a ball. Poor girl. She took a violent cold as the result of a night of dancing, sickened, and died. At her funeral, the minister expressed some doubts as to her acceptance with the Lord. We children learned the do-re-mi from the choir leader, who always started the singing with a tuning fork. As he placed this to his ear, he would do the do, then those of the other parts of the music would sound their first note before singing. There came a time when a man stood at the head of the choir with a violin, with which to give the leading note. Though it was a decided improvement, it displeased some of the members who thought that no instrumental music should be used in the Lord's house. They thought the violin's only use was the devil's music in dance halls. Once, when my father was constructing a certain house, there was quite a large pile of stones which they wanted moved to the other side of the fence. My uncle, who was one of the carpenters, said if I would move them with my little wheelbarrow, I would find a sixpence, 12.5 cents, under the last stone. Of course, I worked hard to get the last stone, and sure enough, there was the sixpence. I knew very well that my uncle had to divert my attention just before I picked up that last stone. The interesting thing is the use that I made of that sixpence. At that time, the Methodists were carrying on missionary work on the west coast of Africa. My sympathies were aroused, and I decided that my sixpence should buy a testament for some poor heathen boy. There was to be a meeting at the minister's house that week for the people to bring clothing, money, etc., to send to Africa. The day of the missionary meeting, I was sent to the store for some article. Whether to test me or not, the merchant showed me some things he knew I loved and offered to sell them for a sixpence. There was a struggle within me whether to buy the articles or not. Then I thought of the poor heathen and left the store on a run. I hurried to the minister's house just as the people were gathering and handed him the sixpence, saying, I want to send a testament to the poor heathen. Then I left for home as suddenly as I had come. And as I went out, I saw the minister holding up the sixpence and talking to the people. Some of them shed tears. I imagine he made my sixpence tell for more than 12.5 cents. I knew that I felt very happy afterwards. In the winter of 1837, the night after my 6th birthday, a terrible sight appeared in the heavens and continued for the whole night. It was the fiery aurora. A man and his wife living directly across from our home had taken my father and mother for a sleigh ride to spend the evening with another family 2 miles away. Two girls from the neighbor's family and a Miss Horton, 18 years of age, came to spend the evening with us children. About 7 o'clock, while we were enjoying our childish sports, there came a sudden flash of red light. My brother cried out, "The house is afire!" And we all rushed out of doors. What a sight greeted our eyes! The whole heavens had the appearance of a red flame mingled with cloudy vapor. The reflection of this upon the snow appeared like fire rolling in waves down from the hillside. Even Miss Horton was startled and cried out, "The world is coming to an end!" Our parents, who anticipated our terror, was soon home to calm our fright. Some of the neighbors sat up all night to watch the ever-changing grandeur. The aurora was seen all over the then-settled portions of the United States. During the summer of 1839, my father had 17 men in his employ. In addition to his cabinet and chair business, he built houses and constructed horsepowers for threshing machines. He was also the only coffin maker for a large section of the surrounding country. Besides giving attention to all his business, he spent nearly every Sunday holding meetings in the Methodist Church. Sometimes, on arriving home at 11 o'clock at night, he would find an order for a coffin which must be had the next day, and the rest of the night must be spent in making it. Notwithstanding, he was a man of vigorous constitution, and only 35 years of age, it is no marvel that in September he was confined to his bed with typhoid fever, with little vital force remaining to expel the disease from his system. Those were the days of bleeding and dosing with calomel for every affliction. A patient was not allowed any water or fresh air. When I think of how my father was served by a physician of that time, it is no wonder that he died. My father's funeral was attended by about 2,000 people, nearly all mourners. Dearly did I love my father. As I saw him covered up in the cold ground, I began to realize that I could see him no more. With a sad heart, I went to make my home with my grandfather, who was a Methodist class leader. What the different ministers said at other funerals I attended about this time brought me both joy and sadness. I distinctly remember one prominent minister saying that the saints in heaven would sit on the edge of a cloud and sing psalm tunes forever. Not having any idea how far it was to heaven, I fancied it might be that some of those beautiful, shining, fleecy clouds of summer, piling up like bales of purest wool, appeared so glorious because the saints were on them. Many an hour did I sit watching these clouds and wondering if I could hear them sing, but alas, they always seemed to stay on the other side of the cloud. At a funeral I attended 6 months later, the minister declared the soul to be immortal and invisible, and so small that 30,000 could dance on the point of a needle. This sadly destroyed my childish fancy about the bright clouds. Although my grandparents believed the coming of the Lord to be near, they also believed we were to occupy till I come. So they wished me to get a good education. Not only was I anxious to secure education from books, but also in the use of tools. A cousin of mine had a violin. Since I had no money to purchase one, I made one. Shaping the bulge of the instrument from a beech board, I never became a violinist. A physician in the village, to encourage me, paid me a good price for the instrument, for it was a careful copy of those sold in music stores. As I began in school to study Comstock's philosophy, I wanted to make everything described in the book. I constructed an electrical machine with its glass cylinder for generating electricity, the laying jar with thunder tongs, dancing jacks, hair-raising images, and other paraphernalia. Then I made a galvanic battery of copper and zinc with a rasp electric coil for administering electrical shocks. I did not consider the making of these things any great feat, but soon I was branded the philosopher and was even called to administer for pay electrical treatments to a paralytic. In my grandfather's household, in addition to butchering a cow each fall, they killed 3 fat hogs. From these came the meat supply for a year. Of course, the fresh beef was the diet for a very few days, and after that, corned beef and dried smoked beef. The pork was the standard diet, and all the fat used freely in shortcakes and pie crusts, etc. Flesh food was a staple article of diet 3 times a day. Fried pork with Java coffee for breakfast, boiled pork for dinner, and if baked beans were a part of the fare, they were not considered ready without a nice piece of pork on top. For supper, we had dried beef or ham, and shortcake so full of lard you could almost squeeze out the grease. For appetizers, we had mustard, pickles, horseradish, and good sharp cider vinegar. Grandfather was a devout Christian and lived his religion before his fellow men. It was not popular in those days to be a Methodist, and some of our Universalist neighbors resorted to ridicule and petty annoyances. As we would come home from church, we would sometimes find several lengths of fence pulled down and the cattle in the grain field. Grandfather well knew who did the mischief, for he would see them sneering as he drove out the cattle and put up the fence on Sunday, but he said nothing. One summer day, as the family came home, Grandfather was astonished to see his fine cherry trees stripped of large limbs of ripe cherries. Many weeks later, they were discovered a half a mile away in the deep woods. Grandfather said nothing but prayed for his enemies. Amid all these perplexing incidences, Grandfather sought for grace to bear persecution without complaining, often using a favorite expression, "It's a long road that doesn't have a turn in it." He expected there would be a respite after a while, and at last it came in a very peculiar manner. On the back side of his farm was a long 10-acre field of wheat nearly ripe. His enemies thought to spite him by cutting the wheat before it was fully ripe, supposing it would shrink and be greatly damaged. So on Sunday, while the family was at the meeting 3 miles away, these enemies went in and cut the whole 10 acres and laid it nicely in swaths. Little did they realize that they'd done him a favor instead of a curse. Grandfather had decided that year to cut his wheat before it was ripe enough to shell. Unknown to his enemies, he had engaged 2 men to come in on Monday to help harvest that field of wheat. What was their surprise to find the whole 10 acres neatly laid in swaths. With a smile, Grandfather said, "Well, I think the devil overshot his mark this time." As a result of the early cutting, his wheat was the finest in the neighborhood. That ended all opposition from those people. In his last days, let anyone say a word against Nathan Loughborough, and those former opponents were ready to speak of his merits.